Thank you, Dennis. So when Dennis, Rick, and I were talking about this part of the segment, earlier Rick went over kind of the macro level, national benchmarks, and we wanted to get a little bit more granular for you in terms of how that applies in a real-life case example. What components do you need to take from your ASO costs, all of them hopefully, to compare against either your fully insured program, a competitor's fully insured program, or potentially a TPA or another ASO carrier? And so this is about how do we kind of find out what that right price point comparison is. And as Dennis, Rick, and I were talking, and they wanted me to put together this presentation, you know, I'm in sales, and I think this is kind of a finance-heavy group, but for a show of hands, the sales folks in the crowd. All right, so we've got some sales folks. So for those of us in sales, we know the answer to this already, right? It's always going to be the same answer, and the price has to be lower, right? If the price is lower, I can sell it. And as a recovering underwriter, my finance friends kind of cringe when I say this, but this is kind of where I start with. And so with that, you know, I think my presentation's over, and I'll take questions. All right. Well, that joke worked better on my staff, but as my wife says, they're supposed to laugh because I'm the boss. So what we're going to go through today is look at those pricing considerations, but also some of the non-pricing considerations. So part of the sale is helping, in many cases, an unsophisticated broker or an employer who hasn't been exposed to ASO kind of understand ASO. It could be a little scary for them at first. So part of the sale is just getting over some of those hurdles. And then get into the specific pricing considerations themselves. And again, I'll use a live example from Providence's experience in comparing a fully insured program to an ASO program and the result. And then at the end, we'll talk about kind of the broader market, at least in Oregon and Washington. As we go through this presentation, it will get a little bit stop-loss heavy. It's not intended to be stop-loss 101. It's really intended to distill out the price points you need to compare to one another in a summary. But I'll share some of my biases, and as my friends at Summit and RBS can talk about later, they'll know more than I will, but we'll get started here. So pricing considerations. First off, this is in most employers' minds a fairly complex product, right? Now, there's a lot of perception around that, but there is some reality. There's more maintenance for them. They have to know a little bit more. And so the fully insured program is really, you know, Dr. Seuss. You pay your premium, you're kind of done. You let the liability go. Whereas, I'm sorry? Springfield, all right, good. Versus ASO, where there's a lot more complexity, you have different vendors potentially, you have to know quite a bit more about the math. You're not just cutting a check on the premium, you're funding claims on a weekly basis, perhaps. And so the analogy I use here is Finnegan's Wake. I didn't know this book. Has anybody read this book?
No.
I did a Google search. It comes up as universally one of the most difficult literary reads in the history of the world, right? And not only that, but on three separate lists, it's the most difficult literary read. So now I'm kind of intrigued, and maybe I'll buy it and check it out. The other hurdle we have to get over in the sales process is what are the risk perceptions? So there is some additional risk that the employer is taking on, but they're not necessarily sure how to mitigate the risk, at least until we help train them, educate them on the risk. So the fully insured analogy, and this works well for a couple of reasons, actually. So think of a bank. You know, it's nice, it's easy. They can deposit the money. It's pretty risk-free, but they're not collecting any interest on it. And not only that, after the Great Recession, pretty much everybody hates banks. Well, they hate paying an insurance company the premium, too. But when they think about self-insurance, they know that there's a whole bunch of numbers, which I'll show in a moment. They don't know what the numbers mean. It's kind of like walking up to a craps table for the first time, watching the little chips go around the table and wondering what's going on. They know that they don't understand the game, but they're interested in the game. But to them, it's a very risky proposition. So some of the other reasons to consider ASO, actually, I think a lot of folks did a good job of this at the outset of this session, so I won't dwell on this, but lower costs, the data reporting availability, flexibility control of the benefit design, I mean, then just kind of philosophical reasons. Some employers just want to own their benefit for their employees. It's kind of a paternalistic perspective. They may be very risk tolerant, and they may just want independence from what's really become kind of this healthcare industrial complex where they're just paying premiums forever and they don't kind of see the end in sight. So this allows them a way to at least feel like they have a little bit more control. Some of the comparisons, Rick touched on this well this morning, the bundled services of an ASO versus the flexibility of a TPA. I'll get into more of the cost comparison. So when we're comparing a fully insured program to an ASO program, or even various ASO programs with one another, what are your maximum liabilities? And then almost in my mind, more importantly, what are your expected liabilities? So let's start with the total cost buildup. And from an underwriting perspective, a financial perspective, these look very similar, right? The columns, the numbers may be slightly different, but each of the programs, whether you're an ASO program or a fully insured program, the majority of your cost is going to be the claims. The next highest level of cost will come in either your stop loss program or an analogous mechanism in the fully insured world, which is your pooling mechanism, where you're charging for pooled insurance and you're applying credits against an experience rate calculation. And then your admin fee. So these, to us, look very, very similar in terms of construct. But to the employer, this is how they view it. They just view fully insurance as they pay their premium, they're done, versus when they enter the ASO world, now they have three or four layers, maybe more, versus the one layer. Thoughts, Rick?
Yeah, I wonder to what extent you can get the employers to focus on what you're saying. When they first come into the self-funded world, it's very hard to get them to see this. How do you go about sort of educating them to see the total cost picture?
Good question, and it's actually a pretty good segue into the rest of the presentation. What we have learned is, and this is our experience, so feel free to share yours, but traditionally, we have about five or six pieces of paper that we've shared with them. We've got our admin fee, we've got a few stop-loss quotes, and so they're kind of shuffling paper, trying to make heads or tails of it. One of the things that I've done, which I'll share with you, is we've started to try to simplify the process for them, simplify the presentation, so make it look like a more bundled approach, and help basically pull together the various cost components and summarize those so that they're not having to do that, or that their broker's not necessarily having to do that. Because particularly in Oregon, we have a lot of unsophisticated brokers who sell self-insurance, which is somewhat scary. We're trying to help educate them, help present the total cost for them. So I'd actually lost my voice Friday and Saturday, so this will be an interesting go at it here. All right, claims. I'm going to start with the claim side because for two reasons. First, it's by far the largest component of the cost, and secondly, in my mind, it's the easiest for us to quantify. And I know Keith kind of talked a little bit about this. I'm looking at this from purely a financial perspective. Operationally, claims are not necessarily claims. But from a financial perspective, when I'm comparing my fully insured program against my self-insured program, the claims are the claims are the claims. Our provider contracts for a self-insured plan sponsor or a fully insured premium are exactly the same. We do not differentiate. Now, that's not always the case. And I think you heard Coralie talk a little bit about Select Health's experience, which is slightly different. We have in the past entertained distinguishing between the provider contracts for the two different programs, and we've elected to stay the course with having the same. So we're agnostic as to which program the employer selects. Other differences could be with different networks. So we offer a rental network that we sell to TPAs and some of the BUCAs, as it turns out. Well, I know the price point advantage I have on a unit cost basis for those claims for that rental network versus my proprietary network. So that I can take into account in the underwriting if, for example, I have a prospect coming to me that has that specific rental network. And then the other potential consideration, if you want to get really refined about it, is your claims distribution. So if you know the claims distribution of an employer within your service area, and in Portland, where Oregon's always got to be unique about everything it does, but in Portland, we have four major hospital systems. And Providence Health Plan, of course, only contracts with one of those four. If that employer that's coming to me has most of his or her services done at Providence Health and Services, well, I'm in a pretty good place. If, however, those services are equally distributed amongst those three or four other systems, that's where I may have a challenge in terms of considering claim differentials. And then lastly, we've talked a little bit about this today already, but national network. So in my proprietary service area, I know where I stand against my competitors, particularly for Providence Health and Services incurred claims. But when we get to a national network, I know that I'm at a disadvantage, particularly against the nationals. And so if an employer has a strong employee population outside of my service area, I may have to take that into account as part of that claims buildup. Questions on any of this? So the question is, does that leave us not being competitive, potentially? So for example, in either of those two scenarios, whether it's local, but a lot of the services are going to one of those other three hospital systems, and or if there's, say, 50% of the population outside of my service area, then yes, I may not be the most competitive, either self-insured or fully insured option for that employer. Conversely, if they have a strong Providence bent in terms of their claims, and they're fairly locally domiciled, then it's almost a no-brainer to come to Providence. Yeah. Okay. So moving on to the second component. So fixed costs. So first, administration fees, and it's first because they're the next easiest because we control those, right? We're the ones charging the admin fees. Again, not getting too much more into the bundled programs versus TPA because we covered that. But the key here is with your administration fees is to make sure you go through each line item and ensure that you're comparing apples to apples in terms of your program. Because you may offer 100% of those services in your fully insured program, but in some cases those services may not even be available for your self-insured program, or if they are, you have to go through and add in some of those miscellaneous fees. So make sure that you compile all of those fees. Here's an example of our fee illustration. It's not meant to be necessarily read, but it basically line items out on an a la carte basis. Or maybe a better way to say it is Rick's phrasing of this morning, unbundling the pricing, even though we require them to purchase the services. But we line item out each of the services. For us, the key here is in this fee illustration is number one, make sure you're looking at your contract effective dates so that they're lining up against a fully insured program. Make sure that your subscriber counts, member counts are the same. And then adding up all of those services that compare favorably then to your fully insured program, and then pulling that admin fee, which in this live case example, which will flow throughout the rest of the presentation, the admin fee was $40.86 PEPM.
Brad, I think you might have touched on it this morning, but is your pricing sensitive to the average contract size?
Yes, it is.
Can you just say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so our pricing, and in fact, Jerry and I were talking about a little bit at the break, and from a sales perspective, it's eternally frustrating. From a recovery and underwriter perspective, I get it. So our admin fees are built on a linear basis, on a one-to-one relationship based upon the average contract size. We start with an assumption of about 2.0, which actually pencils out real well with our book of business. But if it's 2.5, you know, it's going to go up that percentage. If it's 1.5, it's going to go down that percentage. And so from a sales perspective, when I get the fees back from finance and underwriting, I'm looking at this, and sometimes when we get those really low average contract size groups, I have a smoking deal, and I'm thinking we're leaving money on the table, so we're having to artificially inflate the formula rates to get to something more reasonable. Conversely, it's a bit of a dogfight for us internally when we have those high contract size groups, say 2.7, and finance says, that's an $80 rate. Well, that's nice, but that's not going to sell. So that's where the negotiations occur, and frankly, we haven't solved that challenge yet. The next component of fixed cost is employer stop loss. And this was talked about a little bit this morning, but there are a couple of ways to go with employer stop loss. Preferred partners is the method that Providence currently uses, and it's more common. It's the easiest to stand up pretty quickly. A couple of challenges with it that we found are lack of market differentiation. So sometimes those same stop-loss partners are working with multiple other carriers in our market, and so there's not a differentiation for us necessarily. And then we lose some control over pricing flexibility because we're working with a partner. Now, most of our partners are good enough that we have some flexibility, but ultimately it's really their decision, maybe part of their reinsurance treaty. And so that's one method. It's the easiest method to get going. The second method is plan-provided stop-loss, and I think Keith touched on this a little bit as well. And there are two options within this. One is the white-label option. The other is fully embedded, where you're doing the underwriting, the claims adjudication, managing the reinsurance treaties. I wouldn't recommend going that route. I used to underwrite stop-loss for a plan, and I didn't know what I didn't know at the time. I was young and naive, and so it worked okay at the time, so I thought. But today, having been in a fully insured environment, it's a very different underwriting skill set. So the white label model to me has a lot of appeal, and there are partners here in this room that can help you with that. Some of the advantages with the white label model are that you're basically delegating all of those really kind of more complex issues that I just described, the underwriting, the claims adjudication, the reinsurance treaties, to a partner that will help you with that. You can also get more competitive pricing, right? You're able to lower some of those fees, the fronting carrier fees, or it's now your paper, your contract. And so you can choose to take a little bit lower margin than perhaps a direct writer will want. It also becomes a margin opportunity for you that, and this is what a Cigna will do, for example, is good luck trying to get Cigna to carve out stop loss, right? Well, there's a reason for that, because they collect margin on their stop loss. If you're collecting margin on your stop loss, you can use that to offset some of your administration fees, and at least from an optics perspective, help your administration fees look better against that lower fee that Rick was describing earlier today. And then lastly, there's a differentiation opportunity here, specifically with TPAs, because if you have your own stop loss, you can build within your systems, and we've done this, the ability to do what's called immediate pickup. What that means is when you have an individual claimant hit the deductible, the funds the claims continue to pay and process, but the funding stops for the employer. So the employer is no longer having to first fund the claim and then wait for a reimbursement. So it makes it easy for them. And that can be an advantage for you as an ASO program. Questions on this?
So the do you let your brokers bring their preferred stop-loss partners to the table?
Yes, we do.
So what percentage of your business, or I'm assuming you do both models, or which?
Today we work with preferred partners.
Okay.
And we work with brokers that bring direct riders to us. We're exploring And for me, I'm very anxious to move to the white label model. Yes.
So with the brokers do you ever have issues with the, I don't know what you call it, but where the stop loss matches up to your plan design? And how do you, I guess, minimize that from happening?
That's a great question. So the question is really around taking your plan document and comparing it against the stop-loss contract to make sure that you don't have any exposure gaps, language disconnects, and that can be a fairly arduous process. So when a broker wants to bring that direct rider to us, that's kind of on them. You know, we let them take the liability for going through that process. But yes, we do work with direct riders that the brokers bring to us. We're somewhat agnostic as to whether or not that happens. We don't charge a stop-loss interface today, so long as the stop-loss carrier that they're bringing to us accepts our standard reporting and doesn't impose any other kind of arduous, onerous work activities on us. We've had one carrier in my history do that, and we will never work with that carrier again. And, you know, at happy hour or something, we can talk about who that carrier is, but But yeah, it was an interesting process where they were looking to basically just deny every single claim, and that created a lot of work for us as the TPA because we're having to work on the employer's behalf to try to get the claims funded.
Just to follow up on that, there are charging a stop-loss interface fee is fairly common, and the reasons for it are just what you two were just dialoguing on there was, you know, because of the reconciliation work that has to go into it and because of all the linkages that you need with a stop-loss carrier, it often makes sense to charge a fee, which can help support that resource. And I think I said that the market price I've seen $1 to $1.50, maybe even $2 in that range, PEPM. You agree? Yeah.
And once upon a time, we did charge a stop-loss interface fee. For the life of me, I'm trying to recall. I don't recall why we stopped charging it. It was just something that, from a market perspective, at least locally, I think it was difficult to maintain. So we eventually decided to just discontinue it. But it is common to see it, yes. All right, so this is an example of a stop-loss quote. A couple of you in this room will probably recognize the format. And again, this isn't meant for you to read, but this is kind of that back to that complexity. This is Finnegan's Wake, right? This is where the employer gets exposed to a bunch of numbers at the craps table. They're looking at it going, what does this all mean? I know I don't know how to play this game. Help me. So what we do is we start to then deconstruct the stop-loss quote and then summarize it along with our administrative fee quote onto a different form such that we try to make it easier for the employer. So we start with this what's called here the individual excess loss. This is synonymous with specific stop loss. And you can see that there are a couple of different options here. One is your 12-12 plan. The other is a 12-15. The 12-12 is incurred in 12, paid in 12, which is an immature basis. And there are some reasons to select this plan, but when you're comparing this plan, when you're comparing your ASO program to a fully insured program, I tend to gravitate towards the 12-15 because it does allow for some run out and therefore gets to a little bit better apples to apples basis for your fully insured quote. So the first thing I'll look at is it on a 12-15 basis? Ideally 12-18, but we don't see too many of those anymore. At one point, Tony's in the back, he'll know this, but at least locally, and I think nationally, Mercer required 12-18 contracts. Those are probably the most ideal comparison, but again, 12-15 is probably sufficient. The next thing you wanna do is look at what the contract covers. And in this case, it's medical and pharmacy. I think that's almost universal anymore, but if you rewind about 10 years ago, it was fairly common to see medical-only contracts, right? And with the kind of explosion in pharmacy costs, particularly specialty pharma, I think it's unusual to see that it doesn't cover pharmacy anymore, but make sure that it covers both. And then try to pick a deductible that matches up pretty closely with your fully insured pooling charge. So for us, at least currently, our standard fully insured pooling charge is set at $100,000. And so in this case, we're looking at a $100,000 stop-loss deductible. And then you can go in and add these premiums directly to your summary worksheet. A little nuance around the commissions, whether or not it includes the commissions. And then we'll move into the aggregate stop-loss. So this is the bottom half of that quote that I showed you a couple slides back. The aggregate stop-loss provides stop-loss not at the individual claimant level, but kind of the umbrella protection. It's the sleep insurance for the CFO of the company. Similarly, a lot of numbers on the page. This is where employers freak out. And you want to then start to identify the options that most clearly match up to your fully insured program. So again, I'll gravitate towards the 12-15. Make sure that the contract coverage is the same, make sure that the deductible is the same. There's one other factor here, and this is this aggregate margin, otherwise known as a risk corridor. Here it's at 120%. In our markets, we see either 120 or 125. Sometimes states will mandate what these can be, so this may vary by state. But in this case, there's an aggregate margin or a risk corridor of 120%. What this means is that once the underwriter calculates an expected liability, they add 20% to that, and that's where the reinsurance kicks in. The premiums are next, so again, like the spec, we'll add this to our summary page. These premiums are much lower than the specific deductible because we're not really expecting anybody to ever hit the aggregate stop loss, but it is there for a reason. And then lastly, with the aggregate stop loss, we'll get into the liability limits. And this is where the stop loss carrier will calculate for you the maximum liability. And right here you can see it's an annual aggregate deductible. So based upon their current enrollment and these attachment factors that are down here, when you multiply that out, you get to $1.6 million. That's their maximum liability, meaning once they hit that number, then the stop loss insurance kicks in. You'll want to look at a couple of other factors, like the minimum aggregate deductible. That's there just to protect the stop loss carrier against large fluctuations in enrollment, and then any other limits which usually don't appear. We then take all of that information and then start adding it to our own form. And this is new for us. This is how we're trying to simplify this kind of complex process. And what we've done is basically put all the stop loss information in and then come up with the claim liabilities. The one factor here that we calculate that's not apparent on the stop loss quote is the expected liability. And why that's important is because in my mind, that's your closest approximation to what your fully insured underwriter is going to come up with for trended incurred claims next year. And it's a way to test how close the stop loss underwriter and your underwriter are with regards to their expectation of future claims cost. This can be a point of negotiation. Your underwriter may have better sense of local trends. They may have better information from care management about the prognosis of a claim. So you'll want to get that dialed in, but that's what the employer should expect to pay. The maximum's important, that's the sleep insurance, but a lot of unsophisticated brokers will sell to that, and that will be the budget number, and it automatically makes your ASO program look more expensive just by virtue of that risk corridor. Questions on this?
Do you address lasers on your high-level overview, or will you when you start using it?
That's a great question. Short answer is no, because we haven't had a situation like that come up again. This is relatively new. This is within the last two months that we've rolled this out. But lasers are a key consideration. So if they do appear, that's an extra layer that we then will add into that summary page, because those are important. Yep. Good question. Oh, so the question is, what is a laser? Let's see. As clearly as I can define it, and I'm looking at Brian so you can keep me honest, but a laser is where a specific claimant, a specific individual has been identified with a condition that's expected to exceed the group deductible, and we've then created a separate deductible specific to that claimant. So in this case, the group deductible may be $100,000, but if you know you have a transplant coming up, that you might laser them and say that individual's deductible is $250,000. Tom?
I just wanted to add something to your question. Most of the stop-loss carriers will allow you to add a no-laser feature, and it's typically about a 7% premium load to have that. So it's really up to you, the broker in particular, whether you want to add that or not.
Yeah, and that's a great point. The no laser option can be popular, particularly with public entities, because they don't want to get into that privacy, that private information. However, just from a purely financial perspective, I'll almost universally say take the laser, because if you're paying the premium up front, the premium is gone. If you're taking the laser, a lot of things could still happen. The person may not be on your plan. You may not even get close to that laser, right? The person may have something else occur that helps resolve it. Or instead of paying $250,000, you may only pay $220,000. You just saved yourself $30,000. So the laser is almost always the better option from a purely financial perspective. Yeah.
You mentioned that you look at the on the claim liability, you don't use the maximum to compare to the fully insured, you use the expected. But wouldn't truly a apples to apples be total in full claim liability on both sides? Because on the fully insured side, the premium is your maximum. So why would you use the expected for the comparison?
Yeah, it's a great point. In a fully insured environment, the maximum and the expected are kind of the same, right? In theory. Now, if you go through the actual underwriting, not so much. But yeah, from the employer's perspective, their all-in cost on the fully insured program is their maximum. But for the larger, fully experienced rated groups that are on a fully insured program, when you're comparing and showing them an ASO program, the best comparison is going to be the expected, because that's how you expect their program to run next year. And over the course of 5 or 10 years, you're probably going, you're going to come much closer to that expected year after year after year than you are the maximum.
So on an aggregating deductible, so I've had a couple groups take that, and I think it's a pretty good deal, really, for the most part. But are you seeing more people taking that, or are you offering it or suggesting it?
Yeah, good question, and I think we're starting to stray into the stop-loss 201 maybe, but aggregating spec deductibles, yes. Those are an interesting option. They're actually a fan favorite of mine. They do add one more layer of complexity, so for the more sophisticated brokers, the more sophisticated employers and CFOs that get it, yes, absolutely, those can be a good way to go.
Back to the question on the maximum liability versus the expected, since you generally gravitate to the 1215, then you have, by definition, also included some of that. You know, it is a better comparison because that almost incurs the claim liability up when you add the runout.
I think that's theoretically correct, true. But, yeah, I still wouldn't then go to the maximum liability. I'd still stick at the expected. But you're right. The 1215 helps mitigate some of that exposure. Yep.
Hey, Brad, just out of curiosity, do you show maximum liability anywhere or talk about it? And what do you talk to the employer about funding then for that particular in a self-funded arrangement? Do you talk to them to funding to the expected? Are you talking funding to the maximum?
Yeah, great question, Mike. We do show the maximum, and as we get to the next couple of slides, you'll see that. Gotcha. So we don't totally dismiss it. It's really important, particularly for the less sophisticated brokers, those employers that are new, to know that they have that protection if just everything goes wrong in a year. But in terms of budgeting purposes, we tend to avoid providing advice. Just that's our legal counsel's advice to us about preventing any kind of undue exposure. But we do work with the broker and the employer to help them figure out where their risk tolerance is. Most of our employers will set their budget at expected, but some of those who have a little more risk aversion, they might set it at 105% of expected, and then those who are completely risk averse, and public entities are probably a good example of this, they might budget at maximum just because that gets them out of the Department of Treasury's, line of sight. So.
Follow on to this. Yes, it's transparent because, as Brad said, they're going to show the maximum liability as well as the expected. But remember, too, this is going to end up on a spreadsheet against somebody else. And somebody else is going to show their expected claims. And if everything's working right, your expected claims that you're showing here, which you're backing up in your aggregate, you're backing that up because it sets your aggregate level, that can demonstrate all kinds of advantages that your plan has, perhaps over competition.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you have a claims cost advantage in particular, that's where both the expected and the maximum should help you out. But in particular, the expected, because that's going to get benchmarked against not only other ASO programs, but fully insured programs, potentially even including your own fully insured.
Just wanted to clarify with you, when you talk about your no laser product, in the first year, you're not offering no lasers, correct? It's that renewal, no new lasers. So you wouldn't bring a prospect in the door and say, hey, you're in. We don't have to laser anybody. So
Chris, yeah, you're right. And I'll put it back on you because I don't have my own stop-loss product yet.
Okay.
I use you guys. So it's kind of up to you.
Okay. So, all right. So I'll just clarify that. When you walk in the door as a new client, even though we may offer you a no new laser at renewal option, when you come on board, you could still be lasered, because otherwise we could really be opening ourselves up to some big losses.
Yeah.
So in order to get the best estimate, right? Because if you're saying that you're going to run this through your claims model and then come up with what the expected claims result is and all the rest of that stuff, how much detail are you getting from these clients? I mean, obviously, if they're your own fully insured client, no problem. Then again, if they're your own fully insured client, your CFO probably hates you. The other thing is, though, if they're coming from someone else, how much detail can you get so that you can reprice all those claims? I mean, it seems like you would be able to do that given an appropriate amount of detail. And
yeah, great questions. First of all, my CFO is a friend of mine. It's a song or something, right? And I've now convinced him of the fact that non-risk revenue is good for him, right? And to Coralie's point, our ASO line is our most profitable line, not only by percentage margin, but by just, you know, absolute dollar margin. And so, you know, he's kind of drank the Kool-Aid at this point. But secondly, in this case, this is one of our existing fully insured clients, so we have kind of, you know, universal knowledge about it, or at least to the extent we can. In the case where it's a prospect coming to us, you're absolutely right. If we're trying to reprice claims, unless we get a full claims file, and I think we all even know that when we get a full claims file, there are issues with that. We can get sort of precise, but it's not like in the PBM world where when we get a full claims file, I can tell you exactly what our cost was on that data service for that drug at that specific pharmacy last year. And in the medical side, it's a little bit more difficult. So there's a bit of Kentucky windage. Frankly, I haven't convinced our underwriters to adopt any differentiation. They just say a claim is a claim is a claim, which can have numerous disadvantages, kind of going the wrong way too, but I'll just leave that for now. Yeah. I'm going to move forward here real quickly. So this is an example of how we're starting to simplify it, and that's a bit of a chuckle because you'll see a lot of numbers on this. You're not meant to read the numbers on the page, but we've basically aggregated the administration fee quote, both of the stop loss quotes and our fully insured quote, all onto one page so that the employer and the broker can see it in one place without multiple sheets of paper. The top section, which I'll show you in a minute, and just this is what it will look like, but the top section is where we basically summarize everything for them. So if they know nothing else, by looking at the top section, they can get a good idea of what their ASO costs will be on a couple of different options, as well as our fully insured program, and then select from those options. The rest of the page then shows all of those, the admin fee quote, the stop loss quotes, but we basically just transposed them onto this piece of paper. So for full disclosure, it's all at their fingertips. As we get to the ASO versus fully insured comparison, so again, this is a real live case. You'll see top line there is our admin fees. The second line is the stop loss premium. It's the spec and the ag combined. We've got the expected claims. We've got the maximum claims. And then we've totaled up the fixed cost plus each of those claims liabilities. And that's three options. Again, option one is that 12-12 contract. Option two is the 12-15 contract. And the far right is our fully insured premium costs. In this case, you can see pretty quickly that the 12-12 is by far the cheapest. But again, recall that this is an immature basis. This is where Cigna is infamous for selling product, right? They go and say, hey, look, how much cheaper we are. And an employer will move to them, and then year two, they'll say, what happened to my premiums as their rate increase goes up 25%? We had a case where the broker, not particularly sophisticated, got a quote from Cigna, was going to move the group from us to Cigna. We said, what are you doing? Showed them our ASO fee quote, which was materially lower than Cigna's. And oh, by the way, most of the services were coming to Providence, so guess what happens to the claims costs? They moved anyway. That first year, the broker got fired. The next year, the group came back to us because they just said, what happened here? And we explained it to them by walking them through this model. And so it's a key. It's not to say 12-12s are bad. It's just you have to know what you're getting into. On the 12-15, you'll see that the total costs were $1.7 million. And our fully insured program was actually about a little over $1.6. So it was a little bit less expensive than the ASO program. And so typically we expect an ASO program to be about 5% less, but it didn't play out in this case. Now, interestingly, that's not necessarily a death knell for the ASO program, because as we talked about earlier, there are a lot of reasons an employer wants to move to self-funding. And for that little of a delta, you know, they might say, well, you know, there might be some margin there. I'm betting that my trend is going to be better than your 1.7 million. So they may move anyway. In this case, they didn't this year, but they're moving to self-insurance next year, kind of regardless of how this plays out, unless they see a bunch of large claims, of course. So this is how we've chosen to summarize it to hopefully get over some of that complexity as well as some of that risk aversion for our fully insured clients moving to self-insured programs. And we've only had this, again, in place for a couple of months, but hopefully it helps simplify things a little bit. Questions on this? All right, it must be pretty simple. That's great. So other considerations. We've talked about this a little bit earlier today as well. So PBM revenue. Cigna, United do this quite a bit where if you carve out the PBM, their admin fee is going to go up. So if you have your own PBM, you can be collecting revenue from that to help offset admin costs, and that's what they're doing. And that can be for a couple of different reasons. One, you're getting margin on the PBM revenue, but what they do is they also do things like spread pricing, the rebate admin fees, et cetera, to help them buy down their admin fees. Carve out, so whether it's stop loss, PBM, mental health, where are those interface fees? How much additional work are you doing? The integration fees to do the work, and then that laundry list of miscellaneous fees that generally people don't know how much they've spent, but they've spent something. So if you can add those up to then incorporate into the summary, it can make your case more powerful. And then lastly, before happy hour, we can get to the kind of the cost comparisons across the market. This is what we're seeing in Oregon and Washington. So generally speaking, assuming claims are equal for us, so this is a client that's either with us, they're going to be with us on a fully insured or an ASO program, the admin fee should be much lower, sometimes as much as 50% lower. And my CFO friend says, well, why is that? I'm doing the same amount of work. True, but it's the market. So there are some reasons it should be lower, but there are a lot of reasons it shouldn't be lower, but it's the market. So if you want to play in that game, you have to get there. Stop loss can be the huge variable that swings it one way or the other. And then, you know, as I talked about a little bit, comparing that expected liability, but be aware of what the maximum liability is. And so overall, we're seeing our administrative fees on a fully insured line of business on average be between $60, $90 PEPM. For the same groups in an ASO space, it'll be $30 to $45 PEPM. Specific stop loss, this is a range and probably not a real representative range, but $90 to $110 PEPM at that 100,000 level versus our pooling charge of $80. And so we do get the request from Mercer quite often, hey, can you just charge us your pooling charge as your stop loss? And I'm like, well, it doesn't quite work that way. But there is a little bit of a difference there. And then there's an aggregate stop loss charge that's kind of inherent within your fully insured premium, fairly nominal. And then lastly, your total liability, whether it's a 20% or a 25% corridor in Oregon. I think those are the only two we're allowed to do. So total cost buildup, generally in a fully insured environment, about $750 PEPM. And then the ASO environment, somewhere between $720 and $760.
When you're tracking administrative expense, how much of that, when you're comparing fully insured to ASO, is direct admin, and how much of it is allocated? And then what's your basis for allocation? Is it just like a PMPM? You get more sophisticated, break it down by cost centers?
We did put away the Ouija board a couple of months ago. We did a big accounting audit with a firm that cost a lot of money. I won't name their names, but they went through our entire operation looking at that. I'd say about 50% of the cost, and I'm somewhat making this up, but if I recall correctly, about 50% of the cost is directly attributable, so we can kind of point to it and say, yes, these people are actively working 100% of the time on ASO, so much like what Coralie went through. About 50% of the cost is what we might call a shared service, so IT is a great example, or teams that are not directly assigned ASO, but they do both. So care management for us right now is not separate. So in those instances, those are on an allocation basis. Yep.
And do you know what your allocation method is?
Whatever the accounting firm came up with. I'm just the sales guy. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. No, sorry for the cop-out. I can get you that information offline. I'll talk with the CFO, and we can kind of share that with you. Yeah.
Sure. Sounds good. And while you're at it, maybe a fixed versus variable number?
Yeah, that's a lot of
detail. I just want you to price the whole thing for us. Thanks.
All right. Well, you know, I hear Austin's pretty nice, although it's kind of getting to be warm there now, right? So maybe in the fall I'll come down and charge you just a nominal fee.
I
just have a comment and a question. The first is about PBM. And my work with PBMs, 2 points. One is you should shop it every year or market price it every year because it's the second and third year of a PBM contract that's bad. Second on that is we've used Specialty Rx, which I think is a pain that we're all suffering from, as a loss leader to get in to talk to a self-funded employer and say, hey, we can help you because we have a solution for that. We can help you control specialty drugs. They're always willing to talk about that. If you want to get an appointment, then you can sell your ASO. The question I have is about stop loss. Just like the PBM world that we kind of believe you've got to shop it every year because there's so much change in pricing, do you think you should shop stop loss that often?
Good questions. On the PBM side, if you have a PBM carve-out, probably not necessarily a bad idea. Since we own our own PBM, I don't have to worry about shopping that every year. We do benchmark it every year. But you're right, the specialty pharmacy is a nice entree. In fact, for our PBM-only business, Providence also has a wholly owned subsidiary that's a specialty pharmacy. And so together we can go into these opportunities and based upon the group purchasing of a health system with 130,000 employees and the footprint that we have, it tends to be pretty compelling, so it makes it a little easier for us. So I don't have necessarily the same pharmacy worries other than kind of the macro trends in pharmacy. On stop loss, short answer is probably not. I think it depends upon the renewal you're getting. We've seen with some of our stop loss partners where they're getting single digit renewal, in which case, if there aren't any kind of claims issues or dissatisfaction, you could go through the effort of shopping it, but why? You probably should shop it every couple of years at least, but it's kind of interesting in this era. It used to be kind of the rule of thumb was every 3 years you'd shop either your fully insured product, your stop loss, whatever it might be, unless there was a reason to shop. Now I think most of our brokers, and this is probably the same for you, are kind of taking a defensive posture. And so if they don't shop it, somebody else will. So everything gets shopped every year anyway. We're not immune to that.
Yeah, I wanted to just follow on the conversation about fixed variable costs. And so the price point here in the 30s into the low 40s, as I said this morning, I think that's the target price point. And you've had some success at that price point, I take it.
We have.
Yeah. And in my experience in working with plans is that the two things that get plans to that price point are one is this fixed versus variable cost analysis that you just alluded to and Carly talked about. That's a big part of the lift of getting there. And then the other part is unbundling. So a question for you is how much flexibility at Providence have you had with unbundling, let's say, a fully loaded HMO moving over to your ASO product? How much flexibility do you have, and how important is that in terms of your pricing and competitiveness?
Unbundling in general, as I noted this morning, we don't do that very well. So there are certain items that we can unbundle. In terms of our, and I like the term high-performance network, I'll start to get acclimated to that instead of narrow network, but in our high-performance network, that's the product that Intel is on. So ostensibly it was a direct contract with a system, but really it was with us as the TPA, and it's a model that we're pursuing with other large multi-state employers that have pretty large employment bases in Portland. We're not necessarily going to replace a United globally or nationally. But for our ACO product on a self-insured basis for that employer in Portland, You know, it's 20% savings right off the top, so why not? Now, it's not quite as easy as that is to sell it that way. Otherwise, you know, I might be in, I don't know, Tahiti right now. But, yeah, that's where we're going with it. Yep.
We're at about 5 minutes.
Okay. And actually, I'm done, so. Yeah. Other questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brad. Questions or comments, or in particular, anything you want to share with the group regarding your pricing strategies, what factors you've taken a look at? Anything? Okay, well then, just a couple of minutes here to wrap it up. Rick, it's been a great first day, I think. Oh, what are some of the takeaways that you've had from the conversation?
Oh, yeah. Well, I agree, and I hope you all agree. Heard so many interesting things. I was thinking, really struck during Coralie's presentation. I told her how impressive it was, as were all the presentations, but there was a comment first thing this morning about, well, really isn't all of this growth in ASO just coming from plans moving over from fully insured? And I hear that a lot. Some people call it the cannibalization of the book of business. That theme has been repeated throughout the day. And I think of sort of ASO 1.0 for a lot of plans has been, okay, we've got to put our parent plan on a self-funded basis, we'll do that, and then defensively, you know, we'll put an employer on if they insist on it, and we'll un-HMO-ize as best we can. And I'm going to call that ASO 1.0. I think Coralie laid out perfectly what ASO 2.0 looks like and what some of the results when you start to get proactive, when you start to get real serious about it, when you put a product champion in place, when you really start to make it a distinct line of business, when you put it on its own P&L, I think that's a critical shift right there. ASO 2.0, so a question maybe to think about and going into tomorrow where we're going to talk about how to penetrate some of these newer markets, the middle market and the small group market, is what does ASO 3.0 look like? And I think we got some hints on that today. First thing this morning, HSAs. The largest growth market, of course, overall is ASO, but within ASO, the largest segment of ASO is HSA ASO, and that was a lot to say. So HSAs. What about what else did we hear about this morning? The advantages that might come or opportunities that might come forth from the AHCA, whatever that might be. Doing small groups. Somebody else was talking about baby group. I can't remember who it was. You were talking about that earlier this morning. Baby group self-funding. So I think that getting out in front of the curve in that next generation of ASO, sort of leapfrogging and looking for the opportunities to do that with your ASO, I think that is something to keep in mind as we go into tomorrow and start hearing more specifically about markets and opportunities. So those are my thoughts.
Good. Thank you.